Today I want to begin where I finished yesterday about different emphases. I finished saying that within the early experience of modernism, the cultural relations or experience was either positive or negative, and sometimes could be both in the same person. So to talk about this utopia, dystopia. So today I want to explain how this sort of thing begins, how it helps to explain contemporary art. I only use three examples, and then I want to explain this text that I sent you. It was Justin's idea, but I apologize because it's a complicated text, so maybe if I explain it, it might be easier. It's my own particular explanation of our current situation. So what I'm talking about today is about the experience of the modern or hypermodernity, whatever you wish to call it, today. So I finished with this model yesterday, an image from two female artists, and it's ironic. It's about a Eastern European history and a sort of a type of imagery that they say, and a forward progress to this future. And now they're sort of saying this optimism about this future in Eastern Europe is not so clear. It's complicated. They have this history. They don't know what this new future is going to be. So that this remembering of a past is sort of ironic. So I want to sort of explore whether there's these ironic statements. Irony is a difficult term, but it's something that it looks exactly or very close to what it's representing, but it has this little twist. It plays with this form. And the reason to play with this image or this symbol is to add new meanings to it, okay? So the question is whether modernism continues, but does it continue without modernism? Or also, does the processes I was talking about yesterday, do they just become stronger, more in English word, intense, that there's more complicated, more difficult to explain, but intense processes of what I was talking about this day with perpetual change, technological transformation, etc. And these are the examples I want to talk about. Just a few examples to explain different tendencies, and then I will do my explanation about this dilemma of creativity. Okay? This first image, Gerhard Richter is a very famous artist in the West. He is a painter essentially, and he grew up in Eastern Europe, and he learned to paint very academically. In fact, he is a very almost when he paints, he can be like a mirror. He's a very skillful painter. But when he went to the West, he was trying to think what he would do with these skills in Western Europe, and particularly in a modernist tradition. So there's a series of works that he and a few generation of Germans do in the 60s that are both... this is basically collapsing the high-low distinction. Okay, we talked about this yesterday, particularly some questions to Justin yesterday. What this is a painting of is a colour chart. You know, when you go to a paint shop or a hardware shop store and you want to find the colours to match your wall, this was just a paintings he did of colour charts. So he kept changing this system, 1024 colours. So it's both a painting, but it's a painting about painting. So this is a little element of irony, but it's also a collapse between high painting, like academic painting, and what you would find out in the street in the everyday life. Okay? This is an example of his ultra-realist capacity. It's a portrait of his daughter in the year 1988, and it's a unusual portrait because the person who's been portrayed turns away. So what you're seeing is this wonderful texture that he does with the clothes, the textiles look so real almost. The hair is radiant, almost like a halo in Christian imagery or even in an icon image. And she looks back and it's a void. Okay. This one is also has a play as well, because what she's looking at is one of Richter's other paintings, which is completely abstract, one colour, grey, almost black. So a monochrome, we say in English, a monochromatic black image. So really he's trying to portray two types of imagery, abstract modern painting and realistic, almost neo-realism at the front, okay? But these images at the back that she is looking at are images that Richter was trying to do a series on the Holocaust, and he said he could never do this imagery, he could never find the right way to represent it, so he did a series of black-grey abstract paintings, okay? So they're just like, history is erased, this event is unimaginable or unrepresentable. So she is looking at one of those paintings, okay? So it's a painting about painting. The very same year, 1988, Richter was doing this series of also portraits, all in black and white, all came from photographs in the newspaper of an event 10 years earlier or more, and they relate to a German terrorist group called the Red Army faction, almost like playing on the Red Army of China, but they were actually called colloquially the Baader-Meinhof gang. There's movies about them now and everything, but Meinhof, this name Baader-Meinhof is Meinhof, okay? She was a journalist and she helped them escape at one stage and then went what they call underground. In 1977, this date, the whole series, all these paintings, the same series, October 18, 1977, the year, not Meinhof died, but the other terrorist died in prison. Now, they shot themselves and created this controversy. How did they get all the guns? How did they able to kill themselves like this? That's not really what Richter looks at. These are all from press photographs again, and what this is deliberately hazy. A lot of Richter's paintings are almost like a photograph that's not quite registering, not quite exact. So the painting actually looks like this, okay? It's hazy, it's not clear, yeah? And there's one work I just want to mention to explain what Richter's position is really about, I think. This work in German is called Gegen Überstellen, which in English means two things. Confrontation, remember yesterday I meant Simmel, where you see someone on the tram and you don't look at them. That's a confrontation, but also a lineup. When you are arrested by the police and they want to know who did the crime, they put you in a lineup and the person who's the witness goes, it's this one. Okay. So it has these two meanings. But this work is three works. Three. One, two, three. Number one. Number two. Number three. Okay? She's walking. These photographs where she walks from the jail, and they had a special courthouse, and at one section she could walk out and you see the crowd. There was crowds of people there, but journalists, police, of course, newspapers, etc. She walks along, she sees someone calls to her, she knows them, and then she walks away to the court. This is the moment of that recognition. and then she walks away. What I was, I'd like to play with this idea that what Richter is really portraying here is two things. One, it's a general thing. You know, you were sitting here, you're listening in a lecture, and someone walks in the back door. You think my lecture is so fantastic, you can't turn away. It's so interesting. But when someone walks in that back door, you sometimes have to look, and you come back again, okay? We have this, it's an old, what they call in English, phylogenesis, something in our makeup that we have to see what the new thing is, and then we go back to paying attention again, because we just have to see that it's safe. Like, it's almost like when we went, lived maybe in caves, and we have to check, oh, is it a friend coming, or is it a bear? Okay, it's okay, I can go back and concentrate. Well, it's this moment almost, but a social moment. And this moment is almost like Richter portraying himself, trying to be an avant-garde artist in the moment when he realizes that what the people who call themselves the political avant-garde, the terrorists, the artistic avant-garde, no longer have this point of recognition. It's this moment where there's a divorce between this, and Richter talks about this, that he wanted to portray them not either left or right, but just this sort of moment of history and trying to figure out his own position. And his own position was that he grew up in the Nazi period, and then he was in the communist period, and now he's in the capitalist West, and trying to figure out what... A lot of the things that I'm talking about here then relate to what Justin was talking about yesterday afternoon, about these different positions about the artistic critique and the social critique. And with Richter, this is a moment where there's this confrontation between political critique and the social critique. So for Richter, it's almost like a moment of the engagement with his sort of form of cultural revolution, the moment when he sort of sees this is the moment I can't identify with, but I identify with their courage, he says, the idea that things can change. And this is the photograph that this whole series comes. There were four press photographs. He only uses three to have this confrontation image. Okay. So this, I just want to show that what happens here with Richter, he wants to talk about different systems in art, but also the difference between, maybe a bigger difference between the political and social critique, at least in terms of how the avant-garde notion changes, okay? What does it change to? What does it mean to be avant-garde today? Here is a contemporary who actually tried to a contemporary of Richter's, Polka, Sigmar Polka. He died only last year, and he did this series of works that were only shown 2 years, more or less 2 years ago in Hamburg. And it has this title. It's like a political slogan: "We petty bourgeois, comrades and contemporaries." And he tries to take on this same question, but in a more humorous way. All the images, none of these were ever, he did them all, in, as you see here, in the mid-70s, but none of them were ever exhibited together. And the problem was, they're paintings, but they're also part of a counterculture. He lived on a farm, they were a commune, and the activities were also part of a way to examine new forms of life and new forms of art. So there were festivals, they arranged entertainment, they went around like a travelling band with knife throwers. One of the women did knife throwing, so it was like a carnival. But in the middle, he has these very political posters, or images that look very political. But it was a range of different things that he wanted to talk about, contemporary life, consumer life, travel. He travels around the world just before this series. He travels from Europe, across Afghanistan, a lot of areas we can't go to, not so easy to travel anymore, right across Southeast Asia to Australia, Papua New Guinea. And he documents these different cultures as well. For instance, these tree houses in Papua New Guinea. And he returns then to the area that the place that the German expressionists returned to. But his treatment of these is quite, they're overlaid. So you have a diagram of people in Papua New Guinea going up to a treehouse, and then these washes of colour. Polka trained as a, he made glass windows, and he got used to different sorts of techniques for over making these types of colours on glass that would then be over and over on top of one another. And he uses this technique quite a lot. So there's one image and another image and another. So even here, you have this street demonstration, and then you have these graffiti lines going through, and then images that come from comic books. It's like all these images start to collapse on one another, a political image, a comic book, entertainment worlds, etc. So this work looks like the collapse of these sort of different systems. He has this one, like it's like American pop art, like the supermarkets, like this explosion that occurs. And even this has a certain German... In West Germany, when it was divided, they used to call them supermarkets. And in East Germany, they were called Kampfthaler. And it was just a sort of a very different terms for the same thing that implied a big difference. So when Polka also came from East Germany and Richter, they developed a group in the early 60s called Capitalist Realism. This capitalist realism was a play on the idea of socialist realism, and it was about trying to capture the new realism of this capitalist West. So you can see down here, they called this capitalist realism an anti-style. It was about this consumer art and almost what they call the doctrine, as if there was a special rule or law that the West has as well, just like the East. In the supermarkt, the German term, the Kaufhalle, the current German leader, Angela Merkel, is also from the East, and she says even today she uses this term Kaufhalle, and she can't help it because she grew up in the East, and this is what they call shopping centres, Kaufhalle. Polka and Richter are both, in some ways, people who grew up with, they're different to the first half of the 20th century because they see and have lived through the horrible events that happened in the mid 20th century, where there was this idea of progress, that everything would get better, to this idea that, to the experience of World War, being on a defeated side, and then how do you live with this experience? So the first thing that falls across is the idea of this simple idea of, that everything proceeds in progress to this future. And so say here, Polka's earliest experience of life was he had to flee on a cart from Poland, that was part of Germany, because the borders were moved. And he had to move to then East Germany, and then they eventually moved to the West, and he trained as he received his training in glass colouring in Dusseldorf. So even though Polka seems more, he has a much more clearly ironic and humorous approach, as I'll show in a minute, and much more poppy than Richter. He has his own traumas. This earliest memory is of nearly having to be on the cart, and his parents were hidden behind under the clothing on the cart, so in case they'd be arrested or taken by the Russians. So So here he does one where it relates to this carnival scene where can you always believe your eyes? It's an illusionistic trick, and he relates this to the illusion of art, art that creates a world and something you see that is created on a flat surface and you think of it as real, and it's like a trick. He likens it to a magician's trick. So art is like a magician's trick. So the woman floats in midair, and the man brings the hoop around to show that she's in midair, okay? Just floating like this, okay? Again, the sources for this imagery come from comic books or newspapers, all sorts of what they call found imagery, not made by Richter, Polka, but put together by Polka. It's this element that I mentioned, this idea of questioning what do you expect to see, habitual perception. What do you expect to see? And that the idea that art, like magicians, are at the cusp of this idea of optical illusion. So it seems to have this idea of funfair. But the key point to this, what triggered this whole series for Polka, is this one essay by a writer written at the same year. Polka read this essay and developed this whole series of works. And it was on the inevitability or the irresistibility of the petty bourgeoisie. And what it meant was Enzensberger was trying to anticipate how you would explain creativity and creative classes, if you like, in this period. And it's a very interesting thing, because the analysis that Justin was talking about yesterday, again about the social and artistic critique, this is almost like a forerunner of that argument. I don't know if they even know it, Justin. It's interesting, but I'll show you what the main argument was. And this is what fascinated Polka. Polka's trying to figure out what is the position of the artist if it's not vanguard. Well, Enzensberger's argument is that the petty bourgeoisie has still existed. Now, the left and the right, everybody has disparaged the petty bourgeoisie. They were the one who didn't have taste, aesthetic taste. They were purely, they weren't bourgeois because they didn't own the factory. So they were sort of in between class. They're not working class, they're not ruling class. They're a strange thing. No one ever expects this class to survive. Now, Enzensberger argues that this designation, petty bourgeois, has confounded theory and practice because it stays, it persists, it's still here. But in 1976, he says, actually. But it's an uncertain remnant. So it's not the ruling class, not the exploited one. It's incongruous, but it's still here. So people have been talking about its demise for 200 years, and it's lasted longer than the Soviet bloc.